East Coast will keep this low-level cloud, and that will keep your temperature in the teens. Whereas if we come up the western side of the British Isles and we go all the way from the southwest of England to Wales, Northern Ireland, a good part of Scotland, well, here there'll be sunshine all the way. Quite a noticeable breeze, a refreshing breeze across the southern counties of England. But here again, we could be seeing the temperatures at least in the mid-20s. And somewhere in the northwest of Scotland, Charles, could well hit 30 Celsius.
Something to look forward to. Phil, thanks very much indeed. Phil Avery at the Weather Centre. Well, now our book of the week. In permanent present tense, the neuroscientist Suzanne Corkin tells Henry's story and what he taught the world about the science of memory. In 1953, Henry Meliasson underwent an experimental brain operation which alleviated his devastating epilepsy, but it left him unable to form new long-term memories. Afterwards, any recollection of what Henry saw or heard slipped away within a minute. Well, in tonight's concluding episode, we hear about an elaborate autopsy after his death and his extraordinary legacy. Deborah Weston is the reader.
By the late 1970s, I had become Henry's primary point of contact for anyone who wanted access to him for research. Over the years, a number of researchers came to test Henry for their own studies. But I felt strongly that Henry should not be made available to every person who wanted to meet him. Many people were eager simply to talk with Henry, but I did not want him to become a sideshow attraction, the man without a memory. I therefore required any investigator who wanted to study Henry to visit my lab first and present the proposed research protocol at our weekly meeting. From 1966 onward, 122 scientists had the opportunity to work with Henry. We were all extremely careful to keep his real identity secret. Until his death, he was known to the outside world only as H.M. Over the course of 25 years, however, he and his story became increasingly famous. His case intrigued journalists, artists, and the general public, while raising ethical questions about experimental medical interventions. People were fascinated by the story of such profound and ongoing amnesia. I was with Henry when he was admitted to the Bickford Healthcare Center in December 1980. Unlike the simple life he had spent with his parents and then with Mrs. Herrick, Henry's time in the nursing home offered many opportunities for engaging in activities and interacting with lots of people. He willingly took part in all sorts of activities: choral practice, bingo, Bible study, film watching, and arts and crafts. He spent time in the lounge watching TV and liked to sit in the small courtyard in front of the facility. He continued to do crossword puzzles. My lab gave him a monthly subscription to a crossword publication, so he always had a fresh supply. He attended special events held at the home and even danced the hula at a Hawaiian party. With his craft projects, he was a perfectionist, displaying the attention to detail he had shown in the skilled labor of his younger days. Although Henry could not form relationships in the usual sense, he did interact with other patients. He seemed to prefer the company of men. A couple of years into his stay, he made friends with another patient, Charlie, and they often watched TV together. He told the nurses that he liked to let his hair down and be one of the guys. Life in the nursing home, however, was not always smooth for Henry. His mood was sometimes marked by confusion, frustration, and anger. From time to time, he would become agitated if another patient was loud or wanted to watch a TV show he did not. He could become irritated easily by noise or other physical discomforts, such as abdominal or joint pain. In addition to his memory impairment, Henry began to deal with the degradations of old age, developing an increasing number of physical complaints and struggling with simple daily tasks. He had numerous falls, and at 60, he had his left hip joint replaced. At 75, he became fully dependent on a wheelchair. Even then, however, his intellect and sense of humor remained intact. In March 2002, during a visit to MIT, a researcher asked Henry whether he had slept well. "I didn't stay awake to find out," he replied. As we watched Henry's overall health worsen, we knew that his brain was undergoing the changes that are part of getting old, independent of the damage caused by his 1953 operation. By 2000, he had decreased concentration and increased confusion. He had a tendency to worry and become impatient. As he observed, "I'm always on edge." His speech was slurred, perhaps from too much medication, and he slept a lot in his geriatric chair. By 2005, Henry had crossed over from amnesia plus healthy aging to amnesia plus dementia. During the 1980s, when I was studying Alzheimer's disease, I learned the importance of brain donation. As Henry began to decline, I focused on ensuring that we would be able to study his brain after he died. Although we could learn a great deal through brain imaging, the only way to learn conclusively about the status of his remaining tissue was to examine it microscopically. The last time I saw Henry alive was on September 16, 2008, during my annual pilgrimage to Bickford. He was now 82, and it had been 46 years since Henry and I first met. In the course of those years, he had been a regular presence in my life. We had watched one another age over the decades, although he did not know it. One great gift that memory bestows on us is the ability to know one another well. It is through shared experiences and conversations that we form our deepest relationships. And without the ability to remember, we cannot watch these relationships grow. Although Henry had acquired many friends during his life, he was unable to feel the true depths of these connections. Just before 5:30 on the afternoon of December 2, 2008, I received a call from the director of nursing at Bickford. Henry had died a few minutes earlier. Henry, the amiable, smiling man who had been a part of my life for so many years, was now gone. But at that moment, I had no time to mourn. Henry was dead, but he remained a precious research participant. It was time to put into action the brain donation plan we had been organizing for the last 7 years. I called Jacopo Annesi, a researcher at the University of California, San Diego. He would be responsible for taking Henry's brain to San Diego for preservation and further study. He arranged to take a plane right away. Next, I called the man who would remove Henry's brain, Matthew Frosch. Then I called Henry's conservator, who needed to give consent for an autopsy without restriction. By the time I arrived at the imaging center around 8, the team were ready to spend the entire night scanning Henry's brain. By dawn, my colleagues had generated 11 gigabytes of brain images, needing 16 CDs to hold all the information we had collected. At 6 a.m., Henry's body was transported to the autopsy room. So as not to get in the way, I stayed next door, behind a huge glass window through which I could watch. Matthew first made a shallow cut across the top of the head to expose the skull. At the front of the skull, they could see the faint outlines of the two burr holes that Scoville had drilled decades ago, just above the ridges of Henry's eyebrows. These plugged holes had healed well, so Matthew was able to cut around them. Although Matthew seemed to proceed with confidence, he later admitted that he had turned his back to the window so that I would not see how much he was sweating. Finally, he lifted the intact brain out of the skull and placed it in a large bowl. Seeing Henry's precious brain in the safety of the metal bowl was one of the most memorable and satisfying moments of my life. In the clean room, we all took a good look at the brain while the photographer snapped shots from all angles before Matthew placed it in a bucket full of formalin. The solution would change the brain from its soft tofu-like consistency to something more firm, like clay. After lunch, I drove to my office and emailed Henry's obituary to faculty members and the New York Times. A year after Henry's death at the University of California, San Diego, Jacopo cut Henry's brain into 2,401 slices as thin as a strand of human hair. Cameras streamed the event live on the web, and 400,000 visited the site to witness the historic undertaking. The digital images captured will be used to create a massive three-dimensional model of Henry's brain, which will eventually be available on the internet for anyone to explore. This brain will be the centerpiece in the Digital Brain Library project, which aims to collect and archive the brains and personal profiles of 1,000 individuals over the next decade. Even after death, Henry will continue to make groundbreaking contributions to science. I had a 46-year bond with Henry. While I did not speak about him in a sentimental way, he had grown to mean something to me. My interest in Henry, however, had always been primarily intellectual. How else would I explain why I had been ecstatic to see his brain removed so expertly from his skull? My role as a scientist had always been perfectly clear to me. Still, I felt compassion for Henry and respected him and his outlook on life. He was more than a research participant. He was a collaborator, a prized partner in our larger quest to understand memory. Henry's case was revolutionary because it told the world that memory formation could be contained in a specific part of the brain. Before his operation, physicians and scientists acknowledged that the brain was the seat of conscious memory, but had no conclusive proof that declarative memory was localized to a circumscribed area. Henry provided us with causal proof that a discrete brain region deep in the temporal lobes is absolutely critical for converting short-term memories into enduring ones. We now know much more. Short-term and long-term memory are separate processes that depend on different brain circuits. Learning with awareness, declarative memory, is impaired in amnesia, whereas learning without awareness, non-declarative memory, typically is not. We also understand that a healthy hippocampus is essential for vividly recounting the details of a wedding, recollection, but that it is not essential for simply recognizing a face, familiarity. In the field of memory research, we want to know how something so intangible as a thought or fact can lodge itself for decades in the living tissue of the brain. The ultimate goal of neuroscience is to understand how the billions of neurons in the brain interact to create the workings of the mind. We will, of course, never fully achieve that goal. Even as I type these words, I wonder what exactly is going on in my overcrowded brain. How do my networks of neurons marshal together the pieces of complex technical information I have learned? How do they synthesize them into thoughts and perspectives and put the total sum into words my fingers are then directed to type? How remarkable that the brain can fashion simple sentences out of such chaos. We'll never have a formula to fully explain how the noisy activity of our brains gives rise to thoughts, emotions, and behavior. But the magnitude of the goal makes pursuing it all the more exciting. This challenge attracts brilliant adventurers and risk-takers to our field. And even if we will never completely understand the way the brain works, whatever small part of the truth we are able to learn will bring us one step closer to understanding who we are.
Deborah Weston was reading Permanent Present Tense by Suzanne Corkin. The abridger was Richard Hamilton and the producer Elizabeth Allard. And on Monday we start a new book of the week. It's 1913, The Year Before the Storm, which is an overview of European art and culture in the shadow of the First World War. And you can hear that at the same time on Monday night. Next this evening, the shipping forecast. And so now the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 20th of July. The general synopsis at 1800, high southeast Cromarty 1030, expected southeast Fair Isle 1027 by 1800 Saturday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, northerly or northwesterly 4 or 5, becoming variable 3 in west. Fog patches, moderate or good, occasionally very poor. North at Sierra, northwesterly, veering northerly, 4 or 5, occasionally 6 in south. Fog patches, moderate or good, occasionally very poor. South at Sierra, northwesterly, 5 to 7, fair, good, occasionally poor. East 40s, northerly 4 or 5, fog patches at first, moderate, occasionally very poor, becoming moderate or good. West